I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday afternoon, the 16th of December. David K. Johnston is our guest this hour, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He teaches business, tax, and property law of the ancient world at the Syracuse University College of Law, best-selling author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, and editor of the new anthology Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. David is always uncovering interesting stories and important stories, appearing in Newsweek now. If you are among the 20 million Americans saving for retirement through Vanguard, you may be in, he writes, for an expensive shock. The nation's largest mutual fund company is under fire for not taking more of your money. David will talk about that story in a moment. He's also written, as he does frequently, about the wealthiest Americans, and now cites the wealthiest dozen Americans. I have to repeat this because it's unbelievable. The wealthiest dozen Americans own more than the bottom half. A shocking new report on wealth inequality, which actually understates the truth. Probably 12 or 15 of those at the top own as much as America's worst off 160 million people. He's also written a piece about ISIL, with so many people concerned about how to stop this terrorist threat all over the world. He writes about the background of this, how he says it was a product of the George W. Bush administration's blunders. And he also looks at what a smart response might be in countering ISIL. So that's just a little bit of what David K. Johnston has been working on, and we're happy to have him with us as our guest this hour. And welcome phone calls. He always gets many phone calls. We'll talk about these areas and then open phone lines to you. But keep the number in your head, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're also on Twitter, and that's at K. Dunn Show. David, nice to talk to you again, sir. Hi.
Likewise. Delighted to be here.
Thanks, David. The piece that appears in Newsweek is really quite a story. And there are a lot of people who save for retirement through Vanguard, aren't there?
They hold about one-fifth of all the mutual fund money in America, and most of that's retirement money. So, yes, they're the biggest in the field.
Mm. So 2 years ago, you're right, David Dannon, a former Vanguard tax lawyer who is now a whistleblower, who stands to make one whole heck of a lot of money and has already made some money on this, filed formal complaints claiming Vanguard's low fees are an illegal tax dodge. Take the story from there, sir.
Well, most corporations are organized to make a profit, and one of the biggest ways that companies avoid paying taxes is they take their profits in a no-tax jurisdiction. That is, they earn them, let's say, in Wisconsin, but they take them in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda. So Congress enacted something called Section 482 that is designed to stop what's called transfer pricing. And in the Newsweek piece, I give the example of a pair of shoes built in Vietnam for $2, sold at the store in America for $120. And the profits are all taken by, on paper, selling them at a low price in the Cayman Islands from the company's manufacturing arm to its marketing arm, and then at a very high price to its American distribution arm.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that Vanguard isn't trying to avoid reporting profits. It doesn't move any money offshore. Even David Dannon's lawyer acknowledges it's an unusual case. Vanguard Group, the investment manager, is owned by the mutual funds. If you have Vanguard mutual funds, you're an owner of Vanguard Group.
Mm-hmm.
And so it only charges its costs to its members. That means they have higher rates of return, and it means that when people cash out, they have more money and the government collects more taxes.
Mm-hmm. And so he argued that they should have been charging investors an extra $19.8 billion in investment fees this year. Why? Because they're charging lower rates is somehow, according to him, illegal?
Because they're not earning a profit.
I see.
And that's the profit. I mean, they manage over $3 trillion. So if you take the average profit of the industry, that's about what they should have earned. And the problem here, Kathleen, is the law does not anticipate a corporation intended not to earn a profit, but to hold down costs to investors. Now, if you're one of the other mutual fund companies, all of which have profit-making, separately owned investment arms, Fidelity owned by the Johnson family, T. Rowe Price, 21st Century, et cetera, you're no doubt looking at this case and going, hooray, because if Vanguard has to raise its prices, it reduces the pressure on us to lower our prices. It might even allow us, in some cases, to raise prices. So the real problem here is a good law, Section 482, that's designed to prevent tax cheating on an international scale or a state-level scale, because many states have similar statutes. By failing to anticipate, a company like Vanguard has created this, what for Vanguard investors would be a very unwelcome result.
Right. So who is this David Dannon?
He was a tax lawyer inside Vanguard, and he did the things you're supposed to do. He went to management and said, you know, this arrangement you've got where you're not charging a profit to the funds, I don't think is legal under the law as written. And basically he got told, go away and shut up. So he eventually filed actions in a number of states and with the federal government. Now, in California, the Franchise Tax Board, that's the state authority there, has actually assigned this case to criminal investigators. I suspect that's because they need somebody with really serious skills, and perhaps it's a way to try and leverage Vanguard on a settlement. The state of Texas does not have an income tax for companies, but it does have a franchise tax. And they've collected an unknown amount of money, but it was at least $2.3 million because Dannon's lawyer got a check for 5% of that amount, and that's the maximum award. They may have collected $100 million for all we know, but they collected at least that much to justify that award. In New York State, a trial court judge, here in New York we call our trial court the Supreme Court. It's a good example of what's wrong with New York State government. A trial court judge said Mr. Dannon cannot collect any reward because, as an insider, he was involved in this. Now, that decision is under appeal. It has no effect on whether taxes are owed, but it should be worrisome to all of us because, of course, all whistleblowers come in because they were in some way involved. That's how they knew about
sure.
what was going on and tried to stop it. And if you say whistleblowers can never collect because they were on the inside, you basically are then vitiating all of the whistleblower laws.
Yeah, but to collect this kind of money, this guy could make a whole ton of money. You say that $117,000 whistleblower bounty just from Texas.
Right. In theory, if the whole nine yards came his way, he could collect $10.5 billion.
Whoa!
I will be shocked if he collects so much as $100 million, but the idea of the whistleblower law that Congress passed in 2006 in the wake of Enron and other scandals was we'll give 15% to 30% of the money we would not have gotten to the whistleblower. And the reason you want to do that is every whistleblower, Kathleen, I have dealt with in what is now almost a half century of reporting has come to, you know, just terrible. I mean, you decide to become a whistleblower, you're
right.
just blowing up your life forever.
Right.
You risk, in many cases, prosecution. I've saved a couple of whistleblowers from being prosecuted who did the right thing just by saying, well, fine, you know, we're just going to cover the criminal case if you prosecute this person to the ends of the earth. And then the government decides that, well, perhaps there are more important cases to pursue.
Mm-hmm. So how long has Vanguard been charging these low fees?
Since it was founded 40 years ago.
40 years ago?
Yes. Now, they did, Kathleen, Vanguard's founder, Jack Bogle, whose whole idea was we need to lower the fees to investors and we should have index fees, index funds primarily to track the whole market. His team went and got this arrangement blessed by the Securities and Exchange Commission. And they're resting their argument on we told the SEC what we were doing and they said it was fine with them. The problem is they're the Wall Street police. The IRS are the tax police, mm-hmm. and they did not go clear this with the tax police. They might have been able back then to get what's called a private letter ruling that would have said, you can go ahead and do this, but they didn't. And it's interesting that nobody went after this all these years
right.
because it was known what they were doing. I mean, they it's right in their documentation to the public that, you know, we only charge costs. We do not collect a profit.
40 years, and nobody did anything until recently.
Right. does kind of make you wonder what other stuff like this is lying around.
Exactly. Well, you would think that other investment companies who are charging a higher fee, and people may go to Vanguard instead because of their low fee, no fee, that they would have been on the case, wouldn't they?
I agree with you about that. I do think one of the curious items here is, as best we know, Fidelity, T. Rowe Price, 20th Century, et cetera, did not go to the IRS and say, what's going on here? Whereas, on the other hand, we know they've been very active in recruiting things for the IRS. For example, in Wisconsin, you have in Milwaukee and some other places a community foundation. My wife runs the one here in Rochester, New York, where we live.
Mm-hmm.
A community foundation is supposed to be a public charity. Well, Fidelity, which at the time was the sole property of Ned Johnson, now it belongs to his children, and my understanding is there may be a few executives who have a small stake. They got approval to run a sort of community foundation, and it has to be by law public charity. Well, how can a public charity, which is supposed to have diffuse interests and nobody benefits from it, who's on the board of directors, be controlled by a private a family-owned business? It defies logic, and no one I've ever talked to at the IRS or else can explain how they got this through, whether it was done through a mistake by the IRS, by some foul means, or by a simple misunderstanding of the applicable law, which is not simple to understand. But I cite it as an example that wherever they could, the for-profit, in the sense of actually making a profit, competitors of Vanguard, absolutely have aggressively pursued every opportunity they could to reduce taxes for themselves and in some cases for their investors.
So those people, and there are 20 million of them who are invested in Vanguard, are going to or have already seen a large tax increase?
No. Nothing has happened yet. This is all in process.
I see.
We know that Vanguard is being audited. We know they were audited in Texas, according to Texas Public Records, four times last year and found four deficiencies. So presumably there were for four different years. And we know that California assigned criminal investigators because of an email that they sent to Mr. Dannon's lawyer. We don't know what the IRS is doing. There are solutions to this problem which are very simple. The simplest solution is if 20 million Americans get to their congressmen and senators and say, fix this,
mm-hmm.
That's enough people, even if a third of them did, that we should probably see this fixed. I do suggest in my Newsweek piece that if Congress were to grant an exemption from this Section 482 of the tax code, it would take one line in the law to do this, that the price for it might be requiring the Vanguard Investment Arm's board of directors, who are self-perpetuating, to disclose the pay of everybody who makes over, say, $1 million a year. The assumption of some of the readers, the Newsweek piece, was that they're making huge fees. I think we actually might find out that they're being paid far less than at other firms where disclosures are required. There's some turmoil going on at Vanguard that suggests that especially because they do mostly index fees that don't require a lot of management skill, that they may not be paying market rates. They may be paying people at the low end or even below the market for the talent they're hiring.
What are index fees?
Well, the Vanguard's original fund was called the Vanguard 500. They simply buy all the 500 biggest companies in America, the S&P 500,
mm-hmm.
and they buy them in proportion to their market value. So if the biggest company is Amazon right now, if it's 2% of the value of all 500 stocks, every day they buy an amount to stay at 2%, and they get to the smallest company, they own a very little piece of it. But that way you're buying the entire 500, which is about 85% of the value of the stock market. They have a similar fund called the total stock market, where everything that isn't in what's known as the pink sheets is purchased on the same cost evaluated basis. They have bond funds that are done in the same way. And basically what you're doing is buying a bet on the economy as a whole rather than trying to pick which companies will be worth a lot of money in the future and which ones will have gone out of business.
Mm. So what are your thoughts about this David Dannon? Should he be raking in as much money as he is for being a whistleblower? Is there something wrong about that?
Well, I think the principle that we should pay whistleblowers and we should generously pay whistleblowers is a good principle. I mean, we don't think anything about it when the cops pay, for example, people who blow the whistle on drug dealers.
Mm-hmm.
If you want whistleblowers, you've got to reward them with enough money that even if their careers are ruined, they're going to have done well. And after all, we get a huge benefit. I mean, if Bannon were to be paid the max, $10.5 billion, the taxpayers would have collected $25 billion above that, so it's not like they're worse off.
Mm-hmm.
I think we reasonably, however, can raise the question of, is there some number where it gets too high, and why don't we have a scale that scales it down? If you go and make an investment with Vanguard or other places, you'll pay a higher fee to manage your money if you put in $10,000 than if you put in $10 million.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps there should be a downward slope here where, you know, on the first $1 billion of taxes, you might get 30%, and on the next $10 billion, you might get only 3%.
So what kind of response? Are you hearing from a lot of worried investors, or who's responding?
Well, it's kind of amazing. Newsweek's editors were not particularly interested in this piece when I first put it forward and then said, okay, go ahead and do it. And they dilly-dallied. I was a little upset with them that it wasn't moving quickly, and they got 55,000 hits.
Whoa.
In 24 hours.
Oh, my gosh.
To make the most emailed list at the New York Times, where I worked for many years, on a slow day, only takes about 5,000 people citing, you know, sending your piece on to somebody else. So this was got tremendous response. It's also, there's been a little bit of controversy over it. I point out in the article that based on the study done for the whistleblower by a professor at Michigan, Reuven Aviona, who is the most widely read tax scholar in America, a man of eminent credentials, and who charged $850 an hour for his time, which that sounds like a lot of money to you. You don't know how much tax lawyers are worth. That's a bargain price, $850 an hour for someone of his skill.
Huh.
His report, I pointed out, could, and I emphasize that conditional verb, could result in Vanguard's fees going up to as much as four times what they are now. Reuven says, well, but I don't think they'd actually do that. I think they would just pay the taxes, which would suggest they'd go up by, more than double, about 1.5 times what they are. And my response is, your report indicates it could be that high, and you don't know how the IRS would settle this with them, and they could decide to say you're going to have to take the profits. And furthermore, the self-perpetuating board of Vanguard, faced with having to pay taxes, might decide, okay, we're going to earn profits, not just pay the taxes as if we did earn profits, and we're going to keep the money for ourselves. You don't know that won't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so his report gives you the outline, the far-out possibility. If Vanguard can't fix this with Congress, and they're certainly going to have opposition from the other investment companies, the fees will go up. They'll more than double on average at an absolute minimum, but they could go up fourfold. And that would be from $2 per $1,000 a year to $8. Now, that may not sound like much, but that $6 difference, if you're saving for 20 or 30 or 40 years, means a lot less money for you to live on in your old age.
Right. And when is Congress taking this up, David?
Well, they haven't yet, and I'm sure we will see Vanguard next year trying to do something about it. Vanguard has been very hostile to the only two reporters who have written about this in any depth, which are Joe DiStefano at the Philadelphia Inquirer, where I also used to work, and me. I don't think they've carefully thought this through as a political matter, because with 20 million customers, they should be able to rally significant support to get a solution to their problem. Instead, they just say, there is no problem. Where are you writing about this? No one cares. It's a non-issue. And, of course, that's malarkey.
Right. We're going to welcome phone calls. If you'd like to speak about the Vanguard issue, please join us now to do so. We're going to move on to other things that David has written about, and one of them that he writes about frequently, and they're very important pieces, are articles on wealth inequality, and he wrote a recent one on the wealthiest dozen Americans owning more than the bottom half and what that means. It really is shocking, isn't it? But if you are a Vanguard investor, you might have some questions for David about this particular story, which is being to say the least, wildly underreported. David wrote about this for Newsweek recently. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, where we love to read your messages, is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And if you like us there, then we'll send you announcements. We're not invasive in any way, but you'll know what shows are coming up, which you may want to listen to. It's a good thing. That's The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, at K Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to phone calls for David K. Johnston on Vanguard story first, and then we'll move to the wealthiest dozen Americans. Karen in Milwaukee, our first caller for you, David. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Maybe I'm not getting it, but the way it was described, where they're being, the investors are being charged very little, and then it goes back to them at on the other end, it seems more like a cooperative to me. I don't see the what's bad about it. That's a very good insight.
The law doesn't have a provision that allows a financial services company like this to operate as a financial cooperative. If it was set up as a co-op, there'd be no issue. But Vanguard Group, that's the money investment entity, is what's known as a C corporation. Every big company you know of in the country, the New York Times, General Electric, Apple, those are all C corporations, not cooperatives. And so this is a legal structural problem that could be fixed, but it will require, I believe, Congress to step in and add one line of code allowing this either as a cooperative or as an exemption from the rules of Section 482.
Okay, because nobody's really being hurt here as far as being overcharged or anything, right?
Well, I have not, neither Reuben, whom I know well, or I have done the very intense work that would require to calculate whether the government makes more or less money because the investors have more money. Because the government would be collecting 35%, at least in theory, of $19.8 billion a year, it may well be the government would be a little better off making you worse off, because of the time value of the money. But it's not terribly far apart, and I think the real issue here is if Vanguard were to lose this case and if it were to mismanage this case, not only would your fees go up, but it would encourage other mutual funds not to lower their fees or even raise theirs, and at a time when Congress people left and right are saying people don't have enough money for retirement, especially those at the tail end of the boomers and what follows, then we would exacerbate the coming problem of inadequate income in old age.
Thank you, Karen, so much for your call, 800-486-8655. I wanted to cover a couple other of your pieces, and you can talk about Vanguard, but I want to move into the wealthiest dozen Americans, owning more than the bottom half, which is absolutely flabbergasting to me, David. And then you cite also this piece that was done about a month ago, 158 families owning or controlling, along with the companies they own or control, providing nearly half of the contributions to the presidential candidates. A dozen Americans owning more than the bottom
half. Well, somewhere between a dozen and 15. There were, a study was done by Chuck Collins and a colleague who, like me, are longtime observers about the rising inequality in this country, which I've been writing about now for almost 21 years,
yes.
So long before it was a household topic. And they put out a report saying it looks to the, from the data in the Forbes 400 list, that the top 20 wealth holders on the Forbes list have as much money as the bottom half of Americans. Well, the Forbes list is very incomplete. A good example is Warren Buffett. They only cite Warren Buffett's investments in Berkshire Hathaway, but we know from the tax data he released a few years ago and some other things that Warren Buffett has a whole large separate fortune. We don't know how big it is, but he has another huge fortune. We know that Larry Ellison, the third richest person on the Forbes list, has sold enormous amounts of his stock over the years and acquired other assets. So the Forbes list, for most of the people on it, especially at the very top, significantly understates their wealth, and as a result, My point was that it isn't 20 people, it's 15, perhaps as few as 12. And the image they used was that if you had bought a Gulfstream G650, that is the top Gulfstream jet, those are the private jets with the picture windows instead of those little windows we're all used to, that would hold 20 people. And I made the point that, well, actually, a much smaller jet, you could put 12 or 15 in it and probably come up, if we had a real figure, with wealth equal to the bottom half. The bottom half of Americans essentially have no wealth. Their combined wealth is well less than one-half of 1% of the total wealth of this country.
Whew. Isn't it something? And certainly there are presidential candidates who are making mention of this, Bernie Sanders most notably. Is this an issue? There have been people who are upset about this. It's just an incredibly shocking statistic, David. What does it do to the country? What does it do to democracy? And why aren't we really demanding a change in this?
It costs you and I as taxpayers a lot of money. It's terribly expensive. In Western European countries, where you don't have this, people may not have nearly as much wealth, but they tend to own their own homes. They tend to own them free and clear by the time they're middle-aged or older. I was in Stockholm 7 years ago, and I spoke with a dozen tourist bus drivers. It turned out that every one of them owned two homes free and clear.
Really?
A city home and a country home. Yeah.
Ooh.
And this is very common to find. In the year before, when I was speaking at a journalism conference in the Netherlands, I met a young woman who was embarrassed to say that she had borrowed money to buy a car, and the reason turned out to be that somebody hit her, and her insurance settlement gave her enough to replace the car with her savings that she had, but she and her boyfriend were planning to get married, and they were going to have babies, so she got a little bit bigger car, so she took out a short-term loan, because she had to have a car to get to work and to go around doing her reporting. But she was embarrassed about this. And then I said, well, when are you going to get married? And she said, well, as soon as we can buy a house. And I said, oh, when do you have the down payment saved? And she said, down payment? I said, what? And she said, no, we'll get married and have children as soon as we can buy a house. And I said, when's that? And she said, well, we've been saving for 8 years. I think maybe next year we'll be able to do it.
Isn't that something?
Not what you hear Americans say.
No.
So there's huge cost to us when people have no reserves. You know, they have a beater car, the transmission falls out, they lose their job over it, all sorts of terrible things happen. And the distribution of wealth, Eric Schneiderman, the Attorney General of New York, points out, I quote him in one of my books, the distribution of wealth is a function of government policy. It's government rules that influence how we distribute wealth by things like minimum wage rules, tax rules, regulatory rules. On the Forbes list, 5 of the first 100 people on it, 4 of them are inheritors, 1 of them is a businessman, are in the pipeline business. If you have a pipeline, that means the government gave you a perpetual, exclusive monopoly right of way. And the power to charge monopoly prices for the use of that right of way, which means government conferred this money on you, not the market, the government. And we need to recognize that if we want to lower our taxes, among the things we could do is increase the asset level. People don't have to be rich, but have some assets for people at the bottom. A lot of other things we could do, too, but that would be one of the key things.
So all of that money tied up in so few hands, are those people creating jobs at a time when we're, you know, the economy seems to be doing okay, but most people don't seem to be making that much money and can't afford to buy a house and are really feeling a pinch economically. Are those people, what are they doing with their money? Opening new companies?
Yes, but they're not hiring more people.
Mm.
One of the, I think, very clear findings that a whole lot of people have made, and I have observed on this for years, and if the data were different, I would tell you that, suggests that a great concentration of wealth leads to far fewer jobs. You know, when you see big companies merge, the financial press, which I was a part of for many years, typically will say, well, this will be great for the shareholders because they'll eliminate all these management jobs and consolidate. Well, yeah, that's great for the shareholders. It's not good for you as customers because there's less competition. It's not good for the workers. And very, very wealthy people who have vastly more wealth than they can consume tend to divert a lot of it into unproductive assets. You may remember John McCain couldn't remember how many houses he and his wife owned. We have people in America who have his and her jets, not just his and her jets, but his and her big full-size jets. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be if you had a, in the 50s, if you had a private plane, that was a big deal. Then it got to be if you had a small jet. We now have lots of people. Sheldon Adelson, for example, owns two personal 747s, one of which I reported in my book, The Fine Print, is equipped for skateboarding in the sky by
his
youngest heirs.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my. So is it so entrenched that getting a different kind of system isn't going to happen because these people who have so much have given so much to the political process that whatever their agenda is one that's firmly entrenched?
Well, on the one hand, having, as the New York Times revealed through a lot of very arduous research, 158 families and their confreres providing half the money to the presidential candidates in both parties is really disturbing and, of course, explains why Congress is so responsive to the rich and not to everybody else. On the other hand, Herb Stein, who was Richard Nixon's, President Nixon's chief economic advisor, had a saying that a trend can only continue as long as it can continue. At some point, you get things have to change. I mean, and I worry, frankly, that the way they could change is a demagogue. Mm-hmm. And I have pointed out that if you think things can just go on forever with the rich taking more and more and making people worse off, you know, you haven't studied the sharp edge on which the 18th century ended in France.
Hmm. We're going to go to phone calls. Here's a Facebook comment that we'd like to give to you. Kurt in Poinette writes about those 12 richest people, I assume most of them are men, and their net worth today. Could you ask David to compare that with the likes of Henry Ford and the populace 100 years ago?
There are a couple of women in the group, but it is overwhelmingly male. John D. Rockefeller was far and away, as a share of national wealth, the richest person we've ever seen, richer than the first three guys, Gates, Buffett, and Ellison combined, because we didn't have, it was before the monopoly, his monopoly was broken up the trust, that's why he called it Standard Oil, because it was all to be alike and reliable. Carnegie had a fortune, you know, vastly bigger than a number of the people on the list today as a share of total national wealth. But we're a dramatically richer country today. We did not have this concentration of wealth back 35 years ago. I mean, this is a consequence of the actions, which I thought were pretty plainly stated by candidate Reagan in 1980, where he said he wanted the wealthy to enjoy more of the fruits of their labor, and because of the tax laws, they had to keep reinvesting in their businesses, and they couldn't take out as much as they wanted. Well, now they can take it out, and what we've seen is, you know, the art market go through the roof, this mega mansion market, purchasing of private islands. There are people here where I live in Rochester, New York, who have private jets so they can fly to their second home to go trout fishing in New Zealand. It's led to changes that I don't think have been good overall for society. They've been very nice for the people who've been the beneficiaries of these policies.
Yeah. Let's go to Susan in Madison. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Kathleen. I have a question and a comment about the Vanguard issue.
Okay.
My question first would be, what can a Vanguard investor do to support the Vanguard model? And my comment is that John Bogle developed index funds 40 years ago as a very efficient and innovative model of investing with low cost, no frills, little advertising that now appears to be being punished. The lawyer who's being referred to as a whistleblower sounds more like a muckraker to me, frankly, uncovering corruption that doesn't seem to be corruption. There are many more issues in the investment industry that would be worthy of whistleblowing than the Vanguard model.
David.
Well, Karen, first of all, I think there are two things you can do if you don't like what looks like might be the outcome. Contact both of your senators and your congressperson in writing and encourage other people who have Vanguard to say, and send them a copy or a link to the piece and say, you know, you need to change the law to fix this if that's what you think should be done. And I would send an email to Vanguard saying, tell us what we can do to help you deal with this. I want to be clear. I don't think Vanguard management is handling this thing very well. On the second part, Jack Bogle is, I think, a great public hero. I am very honored that he blurbed two of my books and has often spoken about my work very positively. And I agree that this was a brilliant innovation that he had. Nobody was doing what he did at the time. It has made a lot of money for a lot of people because the investment managers took a much smaller slice of the money. And Dannon, the lawyer, I don't see him as being a bad guy here. You can agree or disagree with him, but I think the law is very clear. I make it very clear in the Newsweek piece. And I'm not a lawyer, but I do teach tax law at Syracuse University in the law school and the graduate business school. But I actually think his analysis and Professor Ruben Avellona's analysis is right on. Vanguard is not in compliance with the law, so something needs to be done. I think there's a very persuasive case. Law, you know, complicated and detailed as our tax laws are, this is a good example of what's wrong with Congress micromanaging the economy. My major project is I am writing an entirely new proposed federal tax code that will stop all this nonsense and be much simpler and easier and yet raise whatever amount of money we want very easily and efficiently.
Hmm. And who will endorse giving it to any presidential candidates, David?
I can tell you who won't endorse it in all likelihood, and that is the big multinationals that literally turn a profit off their taxes. Anybody listening wants to read about it, I did a piece for Newsweek a year ago called Corporate Deadbeats. I didn't write the headline, I don't like it. It's a cover story, Corporate Deadbeats in Newsweek. But I use, if you could buy a house on the terms that multinationals pay their federal taxes, you'd buy every house you possibly could because it would make you rich beyond belief.
Hmm. Thanks, Susan, for your call. Richard in Madison, hi.
Hi, I'm pretty illiterate about finances, but I recall, you know, reading about Teddy Roosevelt and John D. Rockefeller and using the Sherman Antitrust Act in 1890 to break up Standard Oil. Why is that law not used anymore?
Richard, that's a really good point. The very first time the Sherman Antitrust Act was used, it was against labor unions, not against big business. And the only reason it was used against Standard Oil was Ida Tarbell, one of the three original muckrakers, carefully documenting what Standard Oil was doing to jack up prices and to pressure railroads that carried its oil and other things. And understand, Rockefeller succeeded because he was a brilliant businessman who produced a better product more efficiently than anybody else, but he also used his economic power to just run roughshod over everybody. We have had a virtual collapse of the enforcement of antitrust laws, which I, by the way, teach in my courses should be called the laws of competition. We have capitalism has a tendency towards monopolization as weaker competitors fail and the successful ones get more and more of the market. And that's something that you need to control or you end up with a society that's all monopolies. And we're heavily in that situation right now of way too many monopolies or duopolies or oligopolies that result in higher prices, fewer jobs, less innovation, less investment, and are damaging the economy. But getting ordinary Americans to recognize it is very difficult. In fact, in my trilogy on the American economy, the third book, which is about this, didn't sell nearly as well as the first two, because I think most people just, they don't think about these things. And Richard is, in the vast majority of people, in not having a sense that they deeply understand financial issues.
Yeah. Thank you, Richard, very much for the call. News from the New York Times this hour. You're a good guest to have on to respond. The Fed has raised its benchmark interest rate for the first time since the financial crisis, even as it raises its benchmark interest rate by 0.25% to a range of 0.25 to 0.5. The Fed emphasized subsequent increases would come slowly. What do you think, David?
Well, it's been a long time coming. Strikes me as perfectly reasonable. If you're a saver, you've been pretty savaged over, unless you invest in stocks. If you're a bond saver or a bank account saver, you've been savaged by the zero interest of the last 9 years. The increase amounts to this. If you had $100,000, your interest would go up by $250 for the year.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tiny amount of money, but I think we're going to see interest rates float up a little bit. There is all this talk you will hear politicians about inflation is coming, inflation is coming. They've been wrong for a long time, and there is nothing on the horizon that suggests that. I mean, price of oil has fallen below $40 a barrel. It's causing all sorts of economic problems. We're going to see a whole lot of small, lightly financed American oil companies collapse as a result. For people who have really taken good care of their finances and are well off, it's been great. They've been able to borrow money as consumers on their signature at less than 2% interest a year. That's going to go back up. If you're an ordinary consumer who's paying the average for your credit card or your car loan, the zero interest rate policy hasn't done much for you.
Mm-hmm. David K. Johnson, our guest. We have some more minutes with him. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter. He has written for so many important publications. He has a piece on Vanguard, which is in Newsweek right now, which we spent the first part of the hour talking about. He teaches business, tax, property law of the ancient world at the Syracuse University College of Law and is author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print, and editor of the new anthology, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. We have time for a few more phone calls if you'd like to join us. 800-486-8655 is our number, 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and we have a lot of messages coming in, so we'll get to those in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls now. We have tons of them coming in. Cheryl and Conover, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm driving in the pouring rain in northern Wisconsin, and I'm thinking our country was founded on people's hard work and regular everyday people. And by what this gentleman has talked about with Vanguard and all of that, all of the wealth and 747s, it just seems to me that the United States of America has lost sight of who built this country to begin with. I mean, there's always going to be rich people, and there's always going to be some poor people. But when the scales tip to the magnitude that they have, it's all Bernie Sanders is looking better every day. You know, I'm kind of appalled. I'm appalled at what I heard on the radio today about Vanguard, and I'm appalled not about Vanguard, but I'm appalled at the amount of wealth that is being coveted by these few people while the rest of the world is out here just scraping together enough money to survive.
Mm-hmm. It is pretty appalling, David.
Oh, I think this is an unbelievable policy change. On the other hand, I can tell you from the emails and phone calls I get that all sorts of people think I'm some terrible monster who hates America because, after all, rich people earned their money. Well, a lot of them didn't. They got it through government favors, subsidies, things like that. One interesting thing to know, if you look at the size of the crowds and the polling data, well, I don't think Bernie Sanders will be president of the United States. He actually has much broader public support than Donald Trump.
Does he really?
You wouldn't know that from the volume of news coverage of the two.
No, he does not receive much news coverage at all.
Right.
Yeah. Speaking of, this is a sidelight, but I did want you to respond because so much of the Republican debate last night centered on terrorism and how to respond to it and whether or not we send in troops. You wrote an interesting piece recently on ISIL as a product of the George G.W. Bush administration and looked and talked about what a smart response might be as we try to figure out what in the world to do. What is a smart response,
David? Well, my column that will be out tomorrow in Al Jazeera America is another column on this subject. But ISIL grew out of the following. As we were invading Iraq, senior American military officers had a whole campaign to win over the professional soldiers in the Iraqi army, some of whom had been trained at Sandhurst and here in the U.S. and elsewhere. And you know, they dropped leaflets, they had back channel, they sent radio communications. And the very second act of Paul Bremer, the pro-counsel of the Bush administration, who had no experience in the Middle East, was to fire every single member of the Iraqi military. Suddenly, these guys had no jobs, they had no way to pay their families, we had violence in the streets, we had thuggery going on, and eventually some of the key leaders of ISIL are these military officers because they needed to make a living, and they finally said, to hell with all of you, we're going to start our own country here. And everywhere ISIL captures territory, and they're in decline, they're a pipsqueak problem that we can address. But everywhere that they are, you know, they immediately set up and make the electricity work and the water work, and they have traffic cops, and they set up a taxing system, and they have courts, and all the things you would expect professional military officers to understand you do when you occupy territory, but that the Bush administration did not. And the way to deal with ISIL is not to put European and American troops on the ground. It is not to adopt their moral policy that I wrote about in my column, quoting them, that it's perfectly okay to kill women and children. And that is exactly what Ted Cruz has done. He has the same moral position, immoral position, as ISIL. He says we should carpet bomb the place. That's a war crime, and it's immoral. And he doesn't seem to care. That's been pointed out to him, and he sticks to that. The solution to ISIL is not a Western invasion. And if anybody listening who read Osama bin Laden's writings before 9/11 wasn't surprised that he was the person behind this, knows that his driving force was, if he believed if the U.S. got entangled in land wars in the Middle East, it would lead America to break up and be destroyed. And we've been playing into exactly that mindset. And in addition, by the way, it's very important to understand that ISIL is an apocalyptic organization that believes the end of the world is near, that at Dabiq, which is what the name of their magazine is, that the whole world is going to end. And they have been bombing not just us, they've been killing people who are in Hezbollah and Al-Qaeda because they consider them Muslim apostates. These are really crazy fanatics, religiously, who are not really Muslims. They're apostates themselves. And so we need to understand who they are from their perspective and the people around them. That's how we defeated the Soviets, by being smart, not by being bellicose.
Thanks, Cheryl, for your call. One more call, 1 minute left in the show. Nathan in Plum City. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have a question about the minimum wage. Earlier, you were talking about how 12 to 20 people have most of the wealth. Well, recently, the taxi, I don't know if it's a site or app or whatever, called Uber, recently, I believe, they have to now do minimum wage.
Right. They are doing minimum wage in one state, I think.
Yeah. Uber was really unionized. That, and other than companies making just crazy amounts of money off of that, is there any real reason other than that to not raise the minimum wage?
The research shows that when you raise the minimum wage, because we have counties across state lines where one county raised the minimum wage, another didn't. We have cities side by side where one did and one didn't. The research shows that there's no negative effect, certainly in the short run of a couple of years, on jobs. In fact, there appears to be a very positive effect on that. And every other modern country has minimum wage standards significantly higher than the U.S. In fact, every country in the world except, I think, three, and we're one of them, has mandatory government-paid parental leave because the society wants to invest in children. And so we're this far outlier on low wages, not having universal health care, and not having parental leave and parental care. And I think it really holds back our economy and makes us poorer than we need to be.
David K. Johnson, Thank you so much for being with us. It was a great
Kathleen,
hour.
Thank you.
Our pleasure. David K. Johnston joins us fairly often. He's a Pulitzer Prize winning reporter, and he won that at the New York Times. He is the author of Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print. He's editor of the new anthology, Divided, The Perils of Our Growing Inequality. And he wrote a piece. We started the first part of the show talking about Vanguard. It's a really interesting story that appears in Newsweek. So he does all these reports that nobody else is doing, and they're good. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. Thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Gift giving. We're going to talk about that. If you've given a great gift, let us know about it. Hour two.